Welcome to Beyond Leading, the podcast that cuts through the noise to get real about leadership, team dynamics, personal growth, and the messy, brilliant reality of work, life, and everything in between. Each episode brings grounded insights, sharp truths, and honest conversations with experienced leaders and coaches as we explore what it really takes to lead well today. We don't deal in one-size-fits-all answers. We spark ideas, offer grounded perspectives, and create space for you to work out what fits your world. So let's get into it. In this episode, my guest is Rich Carter, Chief Growth Officer and President of Advanced Programs at Albers Aerospace in the United States. Rich leads at the sharp end of one of the fastest moving industries in the world, and he brings an energy and honesty to this conversation that I think you're going to love. From leading through uncertainty to building cultures that move fast and what AI really means for your people, we cover a lot of ground. Let's go. Rich, a very warm welcome to Beyond Leading. Absolutely fantastic to have you as our guest.
Hey, Alec, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be on your podcast and talk to your listeners. A wonderful topic of mine that I'm very passionate about, you know, how to lead, especially in an ever-changing environment that we're all in. As I know, I imagine many of your listeners are dealing with on a daily basis. So I'm Rich Carter, as you mentioned, Chief Growth Officer / President of Advanced Programs at Albers Aerospace. So we're an aerospace and defense contractor in the United States that really we bridge both defense and commercial efforts and programs and products. So I think hopefully there's always something applicable to all your listeners as we have this conversation. So I look forward to sharing some of my experiences and some of my philosophy on how to lead in this environment, and hopefully it helps some folks.
Fantastic. Well, let's kick off with the first question then. So when you look at the world leaders are operating in now, when you think about what's happening geopolitically as we record this podcast, technology and AI, what do you think has fundamentally changed about how we need to lead?
Oh, that's a great question, Alec. And I would first start by saying, to me, especially if you look over the last few years, it's the speed at what things have to get done. You know, when I first came into industry, I started as an engineer, and then I went into program management, and then I did some business development too. Now I kind of wear multiple hats doing all of that, as you can tell by my title. When we started, you know, it was big on following gate process, following the Shipley process, you know, for a BD standpoint, you know, PMBOK, program management, 101. And that was when you had the traditional process flow, whether it was in a commercial environment, introducing a new product, or whether it's, you know, in even the defense or government environment, you know, doing a program, it took years sometimes. Now I think with AI and really the flattening of competition, which AI brings, so AI allows companies to compete against larger companies with less folks, less people in a quicker amount of time. So I think the one thing that's greatly changed to me utilizing AI is how can it make you faster so you can compete, and the turn times on product and development is so much quicker. You know, the biggest example I'll give to your listeners is SpaceX. You know, Elon Musk, he's on the news a lot. So to your point, you know, in the past, if somebody launched a rocket and it, gosh forbid, exploded on launch or something, they'd have an investigation, you know, do a deep dive, maybe a fishbone analysis. Hey, what happened? You know, Elon comes out and says, you know, it happens. I'm going to launch one tomorrow. We learned from it. Everything you learn from, you iterate fast, you fail fast, and you move forward. So I think that's really changed. The other thing I would say is transparency. So in the past, you know, if you had an issue, you historically maybe try to hide that from your customer or hide that from people buying your product. Now, as you see a lot of times, companies will release a product and say, hey, this is in a beta version. We're actually going to have the user or the buyer help us improve it and iterate on it. Because they're all about trying to get that speed to market, get that user experience. And that's the best way you can test stuff. So I would argue that's probably what's changed the most, you know, there. And right, wrong, or different of you know, of the examples, I think you can learn from them, to me, is that, you know, basically you have to think differently. You have to move faster. I think that's the two big takeaways I'd give to your question of how AI has changed and the market as a whole, how it's changed in the last 3 to 5 years.
That's an interesting point. So it kind of leads me to think, from your experience, so based on what you've said, what are leaders typically feeling under pressure about now? What may be the top five things that you typically see?
So to me, it's definitely stress and pressure, because planning is harder. You know, you used to be able to have your roadmap and your plan of, let's say, hey, these are the programs I'm going to do. These are the pursuits I'm going to do. This is my balance sheet. This is my P&L. So I'm going to do it. You have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. You know, I'll say, I know that sounds very counterintuitive, but you have to have the mindset that when you come in, it could change. Like, what you think you're going to do for the day could change at 8:05 a.m. and your day started at 8 a.m. So to me, as a leader, how you get out of, or you get comfortable being uncomfortable is lead from the front. So it's not, I'll just tell my team what to do. You know, it's, hey, I want to be in the trenches with my team, helping them out. Because if they see as a leader, you're stressed trying to navigate this ever-changing environment, they're going to get stressed. And as you know, it's so competitive to get quality talent, get quality people, keep them at the company, that you want to kind of at least have some sort of stabilization as a leader. And I think the best way you do that is by interfacing with them, building the relationships, leading from the front on the problems. You know, other few of things I try to do is I try to connect with the people of why we're doing something. You know, a lot of times I think it's lost as a leader, you know, especially when things are changing. They're like, well, we were doing this yesterday. Now all of a sudden we got to pivot and do this. Why do we have to do that? And I think we assume that everybody understands the why, but not everybody, especially as a leader, your team's not always going to see everything you can see. So I think it's almost, to me, over-communicate is better than under-communicate. So we need to make sure to explain the why. Like, hey, we're doing this because, you know, there's a gap in the market for this new tool, and really make sure they understand it. And they're like, well, hey, we were doing this tool yesterday. Yeah, but now the dynamics changed due to this new invention or whatever it is. We have to pivot to that tool. So I think really take that time. Another thing I try to do, Alec, is I ban the word I. I really try never to say, hey, I did this. And I really don't want the team either to say, well, Rich, I came up with that. To me, it should always be a we, you know, because we brings camaraderie. You know, I think it helps culture. I almost would say it helps share the stress. It shares the burden. Because sometimes as a leader, we internalize a lot of stuff and we feel like we have to solve it all. Where I think if you actually have that trust of building that team, you know, with the camaraderie with your teammates, you'll see that they'll take and help with some of that stress and they'll help you with that burden and you'll have more success. I think tying into that is breaking down silos, you know, so it's not, hey, I hand it off to this person, you know, or a seat builder or an operator. I like to have the users. It gets back to the prototyping, getting their feedback in real time, because it makes engineers better. It makes products better. The more transparency, I think, the better you can be. The last thing I'll leave you with, to me, to try to navigate through this as a leader with the stresses and everything else is take everybody's idea. You know, there's always been a principle. If you look at the best sports teams, you know, or even military or whatever it is, when they do a pre-op or a post-op or pre-game or a post-game, hey, what went right, what went wrong? You know, everybody should be able to put in their inputs, put in their say. Because what I find with that is it makes people feel ownership. And when your team feels ownership, not just the leader, it helps be more successful, especially in a very dynamic business space.
So what's coming up for me there is that needs, you know, from what you've said, to drive collaboration, to drive accountability, and make sure that is the norm within your department, within your business.
Yes, correct. You know, my goal is to really have it to where everybody feels it's a team sport, a team event, a team program, a team group, not, hey, it's just Rich leading it, or it's Greg leading it, if that's my lead PM or my lead engineer. It's everybody working together. And I think that's how you can move faster in this dynamic, get past traditional values of risk avoidance, which I'm sure we'll talk about moving forward here, is to me, you almost have to lean into it somewhat and really determine as a team or as a company, what's your risk profile you're willing to take on in order to achieve the results that your customer needs, et cetera. So I think that helps by building that camaraderie. You know, you hear that age old saying, you know, a chain's only as strong as its weakest link. I firmly believe that. And I firmly believe everybody has something to bring, depending on, and people are at different stages of their career. They have different motivations. Gets back to that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I think as a leader, you want to build a relationship with people so you understand, as much as they're willing to let you, personally what drives them, professionally what drives them. So I can tell if, Greg is having a bad day or if he's dealing with something at home. So then maybe we can give him more support because no one wants to come in and do a bad job. So I think if you unlock that desire, hey, I really want to own and help with this, it makes you be more effective.
And do you think that also leads on to the need for leaders to show vulnerability? In the past, a lot of people would suggest, particularly linking back to, we're not using the I word, it's we. And actually, for the leader to say, look, I don't have all the answers. I don't know it all. This is why I need us all to come together. And, this is our team sport.
That's a great question, and I would say yes. And I would tell you, when I was a young leader, I probably didn't believe that. I think you have to almost hide it, and you have to like take the struggles internally. But I think when you show vulnerability, you show, hey, I don't have all the answers either. Let's work together to solve this. But you've been in that parallel to allow your team to show vulnerability, say, hey, I got your back. So if you make a mistake, I will take the blunt. I will cover the team. Let's work to fix it, of course. We don't want constant mistakes, but you want people willing to be out there, willing to expose, hey, I don't know how to write this code, or I'm struggling with this. Because I've always, it's that I remember the comment, there's no bad questions, but you got to know when to ask the question. A lot of times people actually default to not asking, and then that's what leads to mistakes and or problems once a product's released, which is then it's very hard to bring it back in the box. I think I like to share with my team, and I took this from actually one of my teammates. And you'll hear me keep saying teammates because one thing we do at Albers is that everybody's a teammate. It's not an employee. It's not a manager. It's everybody's a teammate. Everybody's developing the product, even the admin at the front desk to the person, taking out the trash is, hey, what do you do at Albers? Oh, I deliver this product. I help make this product, which I think is that empowering piece. But to me, by showing that vulnerability, it allows everybody else to open up and that you don't have all the answers. So then people actually will even be more motivated to share answers with you, and not think, oh, and it also stops that, hey, I'm just going to wait till, my leader tells me what to do, which you don't want in this environment. You need people to, take on responsibility, own the so extreme ownership, own that solution to drive, towards an outcome.
So, with all that in mind, what does this change for strategy in practical terms? Thinking maybe back to the old ways we did strategy, what should we be doing now?
I think to me, from a strategy standpoint, we used to have the 5-year pipelines. You would balance process. You'd have a lot of process. I think now you still got to kind of have that, but I would move away from the 5-year roadmaps in my mind. And it's to me, it's more a short term, like 0 to 18 months. And then you have critical things you want to develop in 18 plus months. But you have to understand that could change on a dime if a new technology comes out or whatnot. So to me, flexibility is like the word of the day. Got to be flexible in your strategy, in where you're trying to go as a market, which I know scares like financial investors. It scares a lot of that stuff. So that's where I say you got to balance it. You got to give them confidence in your plan to say, hey, we're going to grow 20% year-over-year growth. We're going to make this return. However, as a team, you got to stay flexible to the point that you can pivot. Because if you look at a lot of companies, if you go back, like take when they were coming out with the digital camera and you still had the old film cameras, like if you read these leadership books, Kodak's like, oh, I'm going to stick with the, the old film type. And all of a sudden, when they went pivoted to a digital camera, there's already a whole bunch of other out there and they already captured a lot of the market. So you can't be afraid to change. I think that's why I'm saying 0 to 18 months. I would also say to me, relationships, it's all about relationships. So as much as you can, building relationships with your users, with your customers, and you see companies do that very well in advertising. And hey, I'm issuing this new software. Can we have beta testers? That's Apple's notorious for that. Sign up for the beta program, which is almost the users use it as an honor to get picked to be in this. Hey, I can get the early releases of the next iOS. When actually Apple's like, this is great. I can send this out and people can test it and tell me what's wrong with it. So it's almost like if you can create that dynamic to where your user community wants to help you, I think it's huge. But to me, the relationship also is then when you have customers that say, hey, I had a great experience with Albers Aerospace or, you know, or Rich or his team. I want to come back to that. You want them to come back to you, not because they have to, but because they want to. I think it's a very important thing. I think another thing to look at is, you know, as we kind of said, you can't predict where stuff's going. And all I can say is it's going faster. So it's how do you constantly challenge yourself, have processes, have, you know, guardrails to have high quality. But how do you almost always be asking yourself, how can I do this faster? You know, is this good enough? And what I mean by that is being an engineer, I can pick on engineers at one point, you know, we always want to make it a little better, you know? So I have an experience where we had this program to where, you know, hey, we want to get the, you know, the success rate to above 90% of this product. And, you know, I was out talking to a user and the user's like, hey, 30% is better than zero. And what they meant by that was if I don't have the product because you're sitting there tweaking it, I have nothing. I have zero. But if you get me something and it's 30%, that's better than when I had zero. So, and what they mean by that is you always have to ask yourself, you know, is 80%, you know, the 80-20 rule or whatever it is 80% good enough? Is 50% good enough? So don't gold plate, don't add cost to something that might not really be needed there. So I think that's how strategy changes to me. It's almost that constantly challenging yourself to how do I go faster? What might change in the market before I go to, you know, put all this money into developing a technology that might be, you know, might not be relevant in 6 months. So it's how can I make my product or my capability flexible enough or adaptable enough that if something changes, I can change it without having to throw it all out and start over. And I know that's very scary and non like solid examples, but I almost want to kind of do that on purpose because mainly to challenge like your listeners, and that's what we do with my team on a weekly basis, is how can we discuss it? How can we challenge ourselves to think differently? And I think the final thing I'll leave you with as a leader is you got to be present amongst your teams. What I mean by that is you got to go talk to the engineers in the lab, walk the floors if you have a production environment so they see you, they can talk to you. But sometimes the best ideas you'll find is just by walking on the hall, like you see somebody getting a coffee and they're like, hey, did you ever think of this? And you're like, well, no, actually I didn't. That's a great idea. So it's, but you don't get that if you're just sitting behind your desk all the time. So that's kind of how I would tell you, at least in my mind, strategy has changed is I do a lot of reading, both articles, internet. We have great tools with AI and all. You can actually kind of see trends coming in real time. But then also always challenging ourselves is how do we think differently? How do we talk differently? And the last thing I'll leave with in the strategy is there's always got to be a balance, but silence breeds fear. And if you're always transparent, you know, that is going to dismantle fear. But what I mean by that is it's also going to enable, I want to be part of the solution.
A lot of points there, really valid points. And it's got me thinking then, if we think about the leadership textbooks of yesteryear, are we throwing them out? Are they still relevant?
I think it's kind of like, you know, I'll say it to me, it's like when you take math, you know, you got to get the building blocks, the addition and the subtraction before you go into, you know, differential equations or division or algebra, whatever your fancy is. So I don't think you throw them out because I'm a firm believer you should always learn. And you want to always learn from past process. But I think it's like when the printing press got invented, you know, you had to change how you made print, you know, had to change how you made books. So what I would say is I think they need to evolve. I'll put it that way. I think it's good to learn the nuts and bolts, you know, the basic building blocks of leadership, of management from them. But I would argue a leadership book or a management book, I'm looking at my bookcase, I have a whole bunch of them on there. I could point to a few, you know, the lessons of a company, you know, from 1950s is going to be far different than a company now in this age. Now, some of them are the same. Like, you know, there's a great book out there, Lessons of the Titans, that I've read. And it does case studies of, you know, famous companies, like big companies, everything from General Electric to, you know, Danaher. There's a lot of companies in there, Honeywell. And what they talk about is, I think there's a lot of lessons that don't change. You know, so like, hey, you know, leadership qualities, don't be too risky, constantly evolve. You know, if you see a market area is dying, you can't be afraid to pivot. But the how you do it, I think it's going to change. And I think the big change of that, as you kind of mentioned earlier, Alec, is the tools you have available. You know, look at AI now. You have, you know, folks in college or secondary education that can write a whole paper that you or I, when we were writing that paper, might have taken 2 weeks in the library, you know, going through there, the Dewey Decimal, trying to find the book, trying to find it, you know, reading it, writing it. Now you can use AI to, you know, you put in an idea and it can help formulate the paper, you know, cite references, everything else in minutes that took weeks. So you're going to have to do stuff differently if now you have tools that allow you to be successful in minutes, vice weeks, or you'll just be way too slow. So I guess that was a very lawyerly answer to your question, but I would say that I don't think you toss them out, but they have to evolve or else they won't be relevant anymore.
Just linking back to this area, and you mentioned earlier about the need to not be afraid to change. And I'm thinking of certain departments, certain organizations, whereby the culture that's there is causing a challenge to change. Mm-hmm. How would you get around that? What if there is that cultural or change block, and the leader's, you know, there, it's doing everything you've said, but the company, the culture just doesn't support that. What do we do here?
It's definitely tough, to your point, you know, and I think of, I was in a meeting the other day and somebody called it the frozen middle. So to your point, what you're talking about is you have the leaders, they're like, hey, we got to change, we got to move. You then, let's say, have middle leadership that's like, yeah, but we've heard different leadership things before. We'll just ride it out. But then you might have, let's say, new people coming in because, you know, the new generation, well, I think they grew up in a different environment. They see quickness. They want instant gratification. They understand that's the product you got to sell. So you have like this middle that doesn't want to do it. It's tough, you know. So how we've done it, because we've even had to pivot at Albers, you know, and our company, John, our founder, founded in, you know, it's been 10 years, 2015 into 16, coming up, you know, in 11 years. And how we've evolved is, A, you explain it, you know, you try to lead from the front, as I said, but you also get a collective group of team, and success or even doing something shows the example. You know, one thing I think of, we had a program, I know we talked about it when we chatted briefly before this podcast, that a customer came and said, hey, can you do this in 90 days? And they had an organization that was like, that can't be done in 90 days. It might take, you know, 2 year plus days, 2 years. And we did it in 90 days. And there was a lot of success there. I think other people, even internal to Albers, were like, there's no way you can do that in 90 days. But you get a group of like-minded people that are willing to take the chance and show it successful. So how I would do it, these organizations that are resistant to change, is at least get the charter, say, let us try it with one thing and see how it goes. And you don't set it up to where it has to be a, like, you know, it's a pass fail. What you really want to do is show that the methodology, show that leaning forward, you can still meet all the high quality standards, meet the things. But if you give them the charter to how can you do it quicker and but do it right, I think that really frees up thought process and thinking outside the box to do it. But to your point, it is a challenge to get organizations, to get people to think differently. I will tell you, people come around. Even organizations come around when they see it. First, it's that whole process. First, it's can't believe it'll happen. Then they're like, I don't know how they did it. They must have done something different. They must have cut a thing. And then, ooh, it actually is working. And you just have to try to find a few like-minded folks that are willing to take that initiative on to change the culture of the organization. So as long as you get a leader that will empower you and your team, I think you can be successful. But you have to have the team, not only can they be willing to lean into the risk or lean into the new way of thinking, they have to be comfortable with other people on the outside saying, oh, that won't work. You guys aren't going to be good. So there's going to be doubts. There's going to be doubters out there. They have to be able to work through that as well.
Which then links to we need less ego and more, you know, to say, look, we can't know it all. We're happy to learn new things. And actually, it's all about ownership and getting the task done.
Yeah, I think very much so. And it gets back to the we versus the I. We have like an eye jar, I call it. So if you use the term eye, that's where everybody, if everybody goes to the pub, at the end of the week, that's where you're getting the, they're buying the drink out of the eye jar there. So it's, and that's all about, to your point, no ego. Stuff's going to go wrong when you move fast, when you're trying to be, be different. You have to understand that not everything's going to be perfect. And you also have to be very, very passionate about, you can have crucial conversations, tough conversations, be direct, but it's got to be respectful. It's got to be in a professional manner. If I want to be like, hey, Alec, that's really not working, you got to make sure, and this gets back to building the relationship and everything else, that you would know I'm coming from a place of care and that we want to work together, not to be successful, not, that stinks, Alec. I don't know what you were doing. And it's not a place of just putting you down. It's a place of, hey, I don't think that worked. But then maybe offer up, let me work with you to solve it. So I think that's kind of how it takes a lot of extra work on the leader's side, to your point, to change cultures, change organizations that don't want to move in that way. And you said organizations, there's even whole like group cultures that are opposed to the taking the risk because they, hey, I'll call it traditional. We want to stay how it's always worked. But I think if history teaches us anything, you got to evolve. Like, who would have thought that when Steve Jobs came up with the iPhone, that it would have revolutionized what it did, or even I think it was the iPod originally. But you got to be able to think differently. You got to push it, and you got to find a few people with you that are crazy enough to try to do it, for lack of a better term.
And do you find that you've got me thinking about generational differences, and there's lots of discussion about Gen Z, some positive, maybe some not from certain quarters. Do you find it easy? Do you see a difference with what you're talking about and moving forward in this fast-paced environment? Do you find there's any, it's easier or harder to do with different generations?
I think so, yes, to be honest. I think with the new generations, to me, they're a lot more open to trying new tools, doing new things. They also, I want to say, want instant results. So that's different. So you have to, and as a leader, that's where, you have to be able to adapt your style to who you're working with. And it gets back to me, the relationships, understand folks. Like the modern generations, they want feedback all the time, to where if you then go, say with an older generation, they're okay with like, hey, yearly review or periodic feedback. They might be more resistant to wanting to use tools, or like new tools, or like change it, or try to go faster with what's always worked. So you're gonna have to explain that to them more. So it's, to me, you definitely have to pivot depending on who you're working with. But I think having a combination of those teams, it gets back to, I always use the example like Knights of the Round Table, that circular table. To me, I love that example because I don't want a head of a table. I really try to break down the barriers of, oh, Rich has 20 years of experience, so his opinion counts more than Greg. I feel like I'm picking on this made up Greg, but than Greg, who might only have 2 years of experience. But no, I want everybody to feel their vote matters, their opinion matters, their experiences matter, because you have to have those different perspectives. But very much to your point, different generations or age groups definitely approach problems differently. Some people, to me, it's it's amazing to me, because I thought I was good tech savvy, but then you see what some people can do with ChatGPT, can do with Grok, can do with all these tools, and I'm like, man, I didn't realize I could do that. That's crazy. Like a funny story. I was working on my car the other weekend, and I was like, I can't figure out what this connector is. And I took a photo and put in ChatGPT, and it's like, oh, well, based on all the stuff I've researched and the colors of your pins, this is a this. And I'm like, and I have like the Chilton manual here, to where I was going to look through it, and I'm like, that can't be right. And I'm trying to go, oh, that is right. It's amazing the tools at your fingertips. But if you only had a team of, let's say, this generation, or even my generation, working it, I would have never thought to use ChatGPT. I only used it working on my car because I was talking to somebody on my team. It's younger, use it all the time. It's like, hey, why don't you use AI for that? So that to me is where, by adapting as a leader to embrace all the different generations, you can expose yourself and your team to different tools to get the job done more efficiently.
So that links to, I mean, what we some companies call that is reverse mentoring, and actually giving that space to learn from our younger people. And we've seen a lot of success from that. I'd like to just step back. There was something you said earlier about the need to over-communicate. But if we over-communicate as a leader, how do we ensure we're not overwhelming maybe some members of our team? Any tips on the best way to do that?
Yeah, it's definitely, and I think that's a learned trait because it takes time, because you want to be transparent. You know, I wear my heart on my sleeve, for example. But to your point, what you're kind of getting on is, and I'm a movie guy, you know, I'm thinking of like that movie, Few Good Men with Jack Nicklaus, you know, where Tom Cruise is like, I want the truth. And he's like, you can't handle the truth. And there is some truth to that in that saying, is that you sometimes have to protect your team as well. But I will tell you, humans are very good at knowing if you're not giving a full story, or if, let's say I'm giving feedback to you, Alec, we're having a conversation. And if I'm sugarcoating something, people see right through it. So to me, it's a balance of share information, but share and be open to sometimes say, I don't have the answer, but this is what we're experiencing. Like, hey, yeah, I know this program's going away, or I know this product's changing and I don't have the answer yet, but I want to work with you guys to solve it. Or as soon as I have the solution, I'll let you know. At the same time, if something is like, I'll go bad here, like let's say something catastrophic happened, at least have some data and facts. Like, you don't want to just immediately tell everybody, hey, you know, our biggest customer just canceled us, you know, because then there might be mass, to your point, mass hysteria. At least like formulate your thoughts as a leader and take a little time, and then maybe say, hey, this happened, but this is our plan. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to pivot. So, but as a leader, you're going to have to trust your judgment and really knowing your team. This gets back to me of building relationships with the team, so you know what they can handle, because then you almost have a barometer knowing how much you can share or not share based on how they react on other things, let's say smaller stuff. That way then you can, because I don't think one size fits all for every organization. But to me, every time I see a survey or whatnot amongst teams of companies I've worked at, a lot of workers want more transparency. So it's that struggle, to your point, of how much is too much. And I think the only way to do that is from leading from the front, knowing what your company, your teammates can handle, and sharing as much as you think they can handle, but also being willing to your point, what we talked about earlier, be vulnerable and say, hey, I don't have all these answers, but at the same time, have enough of the answer that you don't create that mass panic. And I know that's, and unfortunately, in the essence of your podcast and the topics you like discussing, there's no like black or white answer to these things. It's really, what I love about your podcast and how I've listened to it is the experiences people share. Because then you can formulate like, oh, that might help me, that helps me. And it kind of creates almost, I call it a toolbox, to where you need a different tool for a different situation. But the more you listen, the more you learn, you have more tools to pick from, as opposed to just trying to use a wrench on everything, to when, oh, I really might want to use, you know, this socket as opposed to this wrench, or a pair of scissors instead of a wrench. You know, trying to cut something with a wrench is going to be very hard. So to me, hopefully that answered your question somewhat. I think you got to learn as a leader that balance. And I think learning from other leaders' experiences helps with that. But I wouldn't wait too long, because I've seen it both ways. I've seen where leaders share too much right away, and then it creates that hysteria. I've seen where leaders hide stuff far too long, and then it creates distrust amongst your team, which is very hard to get back. So there's got to be that balance there. So I think one thing we do at Albers Aerospace is we have People First Fridays, to where, you know, John or myself, one of the leaders, gets in there and with the whole company. Now, not everybody can dial in, you know, and then we do it separate for like people that work in the production factories or whatnot, because they might not have access to a computer, but we share stuff with them, updates. Hey, this is what's happening. These are customers we're talking to. This is stuff we see coming down. Because at least if they feel, if you're sharing stuff, that's going to make them feel part of it, that you're not hiding things, you're not keeping things from them. And then, of course, we might delay sharing some things until it's more granular, but it's always having some sort of dialogue is what I would say.
Do you know, I love that, People First Friday. And just what you were saying there, I remember last year that Gallup produced a report on what are the needs of followers. And this was a report for leaders. And it was really interesting that the biggest thing that followers want from their leaders is hope. And a lot of what I'm picking up from you is you're covering that hope, but you're talking about the we and the communication and trying things out. And it's not about blaming. And it just seems to tick so much of what so many followers are looking for.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great statement. The hope to me, you know, one thing like John Albers, the C-suite, myself, a lot of us talk about all the leaders, you know, and like I said, I use the leadership term, even though we all say teammates, is, you know, we have 600 some employees right now. We've grown rapidly every year. So what I'll tell your listeners is these crazy things I'm saying actually work. They do work, even though they are different. We look at it as, hey, we have 600 employees, but each employee has a family to take care of. Or a partner, or kids, or friends. So you almost have to multiply your number of employees by four. So now really we have 2,400 people we touch or affect. And to your point, you know, most people want security. They want the hope. Hey, I want to have a job tomorrow. I want to have a growth path. I want to make sure our company's thriving. And if you don't communicate, if you don't give that to them as a leader, they're going to look for it somewhere else. Or they're not going to be happy because they're going to always be afraid. So you have to give them that hope. And I don't think you give them hope just by being fuzzy pie in the sky all the time. I think it's by connecting with them on a human level, you know, to say like, hey, I don't always have the answers, but this is what we're doing about it. Hey, this is the meetings we're having this week. This is where we're developing or investing in technology. This is where we see the market going. Just so they have that hope. Hey, there's a plan. You know, the company's doing stuff. They're going somewhere. And that also makes them feel hopeful because they're part of it. You know, you almost want to call it like the work is a family too. You know, a lot of people say, hey, I go and work my 8 hours and I go home, you know, that, and they try to divide the two. If you actually do the math, I read a book, you spend more time with people you work with than with your family. So, you know, to me now, not everybody's gonna be willing, but I always want to try to make it like a family environment. And that doesn't mean you don't hold people accountable. That doesn't mean you don't be professional. I'm not saying that, but you want to give them that hope. You want them to enjoy what they're doing and be passionate about it, because that's how you all have joint success.
And that drives energy, it drives the motivation, and starts to click in. I just want to move into AI, and you talked about this at the beginning, and there's something I'm starting to notice, particularly over the past couple of months, that there seems to be a lot of anxiety in a number of organizations about AI. I've even heard some companies are now looking to block ChatGPT through their firewall because they're worried about how that's been used. Then we're thinking about cybersecurity and data leakages. But even before that, I just feel talking to many business leaders, they don't know what to do with AI, or they're trying to do something, but it just seems too big to even get their head around. What is your experience, and any thoughts from your end on this?
Yeah, so two parts. So one, very much so, you got to be careful with AI. To your point, firewalls, you know, so what we've developed and even worked with some of the AI providers is having instances that, you know, there's a certain part of it that can connect out to the internet to get data. But then when you're working, let's say, more sensitive stuff, like company sensitive or customer sensitive, that you almost have an instance that's firewalled internal. It still has the tools to help generate stuff, but it doesn't have that free access. So you can almost do two versions that way. How I'd rephrase AI, and I'll say it in two ways. People are afraid of it because they feel it's going to take jobs. That could be the one thing. I really always want to phrase it as, you know, hey, instead of phrasing it where, oh, I might lose my job, we'll get our staff. It's like, no, if we use AI to do this, what can we pivot you to now be able to do with, now that you have more time, to where now we still only have 10 people doing something, but now they're getting, let's say, what I would used to have 20 people do get done. So it helps, I think, make us more competitive. And think about it also as you're starting a company. A smaller company now can compete against larger companies using AI, because you don't need, say, 1,000 people. I can do it with 100. I think that's important. So to me, it's how can you, don't depend on it. Like, I would not put my whole business depending on AI. I know some companies do, but that's also the market they're in. I would have a benefit. I still think you need people. You know, servers crash, you might lose power. AI can give you the wrong answer. You know, if you lead it down, it's only as good as the inputs. You still need a human input, at least as of now. So to me, I would treat it as a tool that has failure modes, not as my whole infrastructure that you can't live without. But I would look for ways that, if I used AI for this, like we've used it in proposals, proposal generation, response times, because a lot of times customers, they used to give you 2 months to do a response or a proposal or to come up with a new product, let's say a marketing pitch. Now they're like, hey, we had this other vendor we're using for this idea that fell through. If you can be here in 48 hours and give us a pitch, you might be able to get to work. You're not going to be able to do a 2 month put together that idea, but you can throw your ideas on a whiteboard, put it into AI, you can come up with some ideas. It can even help you develop your pitch. I think that's where it becomes powerful. So to me, it's, think of it as like a tool where you have Microsoft Word, you have Microsoft Excel, you know, you have MATLAB. I think of it as that, like that way. It's how can I use it as a tool, not necessarily the be all end all, to augment our productivity. And, but when we bring it in, I think it's important to have the conversation with your team as people see the news. Oh, AI is going to replace, or robotics is going to replace all my jobs. It's, hey, we're committed to our teammates. We're committed to our staff. We're going to bring AI in. We're going to train folks. But if let's say that takes what you were doing before, A, you still have to give the input to AI to do it. But also, let's get you training and pivot you to now do something else you enjoy. That now allows you to thrive and get new tools, but also and new capabilities, but also allows the company to thrive because now we're getting more work done. So that's kind of how I approach AI. You know, some people dive right into it, like take self-driving cars. You know, I've used it. I've seen the self-driving cars. I still like to drive myself. But there's a lot of benefit to a self-driving vehicle at times, or with, or maybe not even the full self-driving, but think of the adaptive cruise control, you know, because the computer is going to see like someone braking before a human. So if you don't want to go all the way, like, so if you take a self-driving car as the companies that fully take AI and you take adaptive cruise control is kind of what I'm advocating for, it's going to make vehicles safer. It has. It's going to make companies more efficient. Better perform, just like analog brakes did, if you want to go back from that to regular brakes to analog brakes. So that's kind of how I would approach AI, is a tool to make you better, but don't think it's the be all end all. Don't set up your whole company on it, because let's say the server's down and now you're like, oh, now I can't operate. Like, you don't want that.
No, and I agree with that. And I think I'm starting, you know, there are certain businesses I know, I think that particularly in the UK, because of our increasing cost of, you know, employing anyone with taxes and everything else, there are some companies having chatbots, removing whole layers of staff. There, you mentioned earlier the need for relationships. It's as if we're starting to backtrack and we're putting in systems to kill our relationships.
Yeah.
And it's all, yeah, starting to unravel. Okay, final question. Thinking about all you've discussed, and I'm thinking maybe some of our leaders, they're sitting listening to this thinking, great, but I'm tired. I'm pressurized. I'm feeling so uncertain. I need a way forward. What would you say to them? What would be that starting point?
So first, I would say it two ways. And I've had leaders come and say this. It's overwhelming. It's one, don't be afraid to ask for help. That's what I tell everybody. Two, make sure you take the time to unplug, to recharge. I know it seems like you can't do it. You know, I equate it to that merry-go-round. I don't know what they called it in the UK, Alec, like that. I called it like that metal death trap at the playground that everybody get on, it would spin around really fast. Yeah, it's like rusted and stuff. There you go. And it's like all rusted. And and let's say you're like, oh, I want to get off and take a break. But the faster it goes, you're like, now it's like, man, now it's going to hurt to get off. You just got to do it. You got to take the time. You got to unwind, uncharge. That's the first thing I'd say. Because first, taking care of yourself is just as important as leading and taking care of your team and the company. You got to have both. And this comes from a self-prescribed workaholic that works all the time. I still got to take time. I go run, you know, I go spend time with my kids, you know, my wife, my dogs, whatever I want to do. You got to unplug. That's the first thing I'd say. The other thing I'd say is don't be afraid to fail. That's the other big thing. I think that's what stresses leaders out the most, I think, in this time is they're like, gosh, I can't fail. If I fail, my leader, my boss is going to get mad at me, or I let my teams down. Don't be afraid to fail. You know, it's why do we fall? So we can learn to get back up. You know, so you have to me, it's less important not to fail. It's more important to iterate fast, to recover, to learn from that failure quicker. And what I would say is I think those little, just those little mind tweaks, and it can't happen all at once. It's going to take time. I think that will help alleviate some of that pressure valve to let the pressure off. Hey, I'm going to go take time to go for a walk at lunch, or I'm going to read a book or watch my favorite sports. you know, I'm going to tell myself it's okay to fail. You know, I go back to, you know, the serenity prayer, which is always big to me. You know, I got to accept the things I can change. Accept the things I can't change, change the things I can change, and have the wisdom to know the difference. That's very important as a leader. You can't, sometimes I've heard another one that's like control, influence, and accept. There's your span of control, ironically, as a leader is small. You can influence more, but there's a lot you just have to accept. So I think once you understand that some things you can't change and you accept that, that will take pressure off. And then it's okay, I can't change that Alec, you know, is going to wear glasses. So it's how do it, like, I can't affect that. So, but it's, that's okay because now Alec can see. So it's, to me, it's how do I work without now you can see that to do something better. So to me, that's kind of that pivot. To me, it's a thought process pivot. And trust me, I've been there. You know, I was starting out as a young leader, as a project manager, project engineer, and you know, I wanted to own everything. And I was like, I will not fail. We will not have a single mistake. And you cannot operate in that system long. Because eventually, to your point, the human body is a machine almost, if you want to call it that. It's going to fail if you never oil the system, you know, let it reset, let it recharge, perform maintenance on it. So if you think of it that way, it's you got to take care of yourself to take care of your team. And I think by just those little tweaks of thoughts, that's what I would suggest to people. And then you also have to lead as example as a leader. So if you're telling your team, hey, I'm worried about you, I know you're stressed, take some time. You got to make sure you're taking some time too, even when it seems you can't. You know, at the end of the day, if I take off a day to go do something with my kids, yeah, there's part of me that's like, oh man, what am I missing? But it's not going to be that giant of a, now granted, if you have a deadline to hit, you don't do it right there, but you got to have those times and plan for that. That's what I would say to folks.
A wonderful way to end that. Rich, thank you so much. Lots to think about and lots to reflect on, and I really appreciate you sharing that with everyone.
No, thank you for having me, Alec, and thanks to your listeners. You know, I hope similar to some of your other podcasts I've listened to, I hope by sharing these stories and my experiences, if I want to give one thing your listeners to take away from is it's okay to try. It's okay to fail. You know, if you don't do the hard things, you're not going to succeed. So push the envelope, be comfortable being uncomfortable, and do your best. That's all anybody can ask is do your best and be confident in yourself that if you're giving it your all and doing your best, that's all anybody can ask for.
Rich, thank you very much indeed.
No, thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day. And, you know, I look forward to listening to more of your podcasts.
Thank you very much. All the best.
Yeah, take care.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one. All right, bye.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Leading. If this episode was useful, follow or subscribe so you don't miss the next one, and share it with someone who'd appreciate it. And if you've got a minute, a quick rating or review really helps more people find the show.